Ajay,
welcome.
It's great to have you back here again. I don't know how many people were here in May of 2022. This is your second DSS. So much has changed. We're going to talk about it. You're coming here in a same person in a completely different capacity. But I remember that. I remember that talk well. So for those of you who don't know Ajay, back then in 2022, I think was the vice chair of General Atlantic, but really came out of a decade of leading MasterCard in an incredibly successful way. It took that company from a $30 billion to a $300 billion company.
360. It matters.
Clearly.
$60 billion is not a rounding error, clearly. Even for Bridgewater.
Clearly. Clearly. But what I remember, and I just said this to Ajay a minute ago, what I remember from that conversation, Ajay, is you, me, Mark Bertolini, our friend, Porter, spent a little bit of time talking in a room after that meeting. And I was very new in my job. And I remember how impressed I was, truly. I meet many people, and there's something about how you were that Porter and I walked out of that room, and we said, that was different. This person is different. There was something about the no BS, extremely focused, a strong sense of confidence and humility that just really stayed with me for a long time. And then you left. I tried to figure out what this job is. And you, 6 months later, got nominated by President Biden to be the president of the World Bank. And then later that year, got confirmed by the World Bank and took the position in May of that year. Let me start with asking you what in God's name the World Bank is. If you can explain that to people, and a little bit of why did you decide to take that job, given that it is famous to be a hard job for people to do.
So, first of all, I'm glad to be back. I do remember that conversation in that room, because I remember he was sitting along with Mark with their back to the beautiful view outside, and I was sitting as the visitor with the view outside. And I basically was more interested in the view than I was in these two guys. But they would carry on asking me penetratingly deep questions, and I had to pay attention. So that's my memory of that meeting. It's a little different from his, right? But I remember that very well. So what's the World Bank? The World Bank is, yes, it's a bank in the sense it does provide money, and I'll explain that in a minute. But it's not just a bank in terms of a financing bank. It's a knowledge bank as well. In a funny kind of way, it's not that different from you. You do provide money. You do use money. But you also try and use knowledge to create a competitive advantage, in your case, to create better insights. In our case, the knowledge is used to enable projects to be done better in countries and to allow one country to learn from the other, both mistakes and successes. And in theory, if you do that well, then you could multiply your money many times over. Right? That's the principle. It's a knowledge bank and a money bank. There are five units inside it. The first unit got formed back 80 years ago, and it was created. It's called the International Bank of Reconstruction and Development, IBRD. And that thing was created essentially to implement the Marshall Plan at the time after the Second World War. So if you think about the bullet trains in Japan or the power projects, nuclear power plants in France, they were funded by the World Bank at that time, through Marshall Plan money. The magic and genius of the model is that if you took a dollar from the Marshall Plan or any donor and you brought it into the bank, and the bank had a AAA rating even today, then you can leverage that in the sovereign bond markets or in other bond markets and get pension funds and guys like you all and others and individual investors who want to create a laddered mix of bonds with different safety profiles and are therefore willing to accept the somewhat lower return from such a high-quality bond as part of their mix. That allows us to raise between nowadays $60 and $100 billion a year from the bond markets. So the magic of this model is you take a buck and then you make it 8 to 10 bucks in IBRD over the course of a decade. And that leverage, which you know well, is the leverage that makes this useful for every donor and every government. The second part of the bank that got created was the International Development Association, IDA. Remember that because that's the part you guys are helping me with right now. There'll be other work to do together, but that's the one you're helping me with right now. IDA is aimed at the poorest countries. IBRD has ended up over the years becoming more focused on middle income or countries graduating out of real development challenges. So think South Korea. It was an IDA recipient. India, till recently, was an IDA recipient. Turkey. Indonesia still gets a little bit, but very little. You know, countries of that nature were all IDA countries, and they've graduated out over the years. But there are 75 countries currently in IDA getting money from the bank. That bank, that money is about 30% pure grant, as in no repayment, no interest. And 70% is deeply concessional, as in 100, 200 basis points of pricing, 30, 40-year loans for that price. And therefore, the concessionality is both in the price and the tenor. Because if you're a developing country and you get a 30, 40-year loan, effectively, it's a really cheap loan to get in today's environment for them. So that's the second unit. The third unit is the International Finance Corporation. That was created to help leverage the private sector and get private sector dollars to go into things where development had reached a point where the private sector could make a sensible spreadsheet out of it and say, the returns make sense to me and I understand the risk. That unit is the third piece. The fourth piece is something called MIGA. And so MIGA is this thing that provides political risk insurance and commercial credit kind of wrappers on insurance to somebody who says, I still need to get a political risk insurance because I don't know that this guy, Nir, who is the president of this country, actually will still be here 4 years from now. So, like, how do I cover myself for that? And then the fifth is something called ICSID, which is the settlement of investment disputes. So it's a dispute between a private institution and a sovereign, which is a really problematic dispute to settle. And so that's what we can help arbitrate and settle on. So think of it as a package of lending for the poorest at very concessional grant terms, critical. Think of it as lending for those who've graduated past that to become lower middle, middle, upper middle kind of countries. There it's more similar to market pricing, probably cheaper than what they could get themselves, but with long tenors up to 50 years, which is really good. And then think of it as IFC, the private sector arm, this other thing that does insurance guarantees, and then the arbitration system. That's the bank. In total, in a year, we probably put about $130 or $140 billion out there across these. There are 40,000 people, about half outside of the United States, half in the United States. There's the talent in the United States is from all over the world. So you will get a ton of PhDs, which is a blessing and a challenge in the institution. But they're very good people. The place is full of people who have spent their life with their families living in places that I would not choose to easily go. And they commit themselves to be there through difficulties. And they learn from that. And they come back and they think they can add value through that knowledge bank. Think that's the institution that it's about. Why did I go there? At that time, I tried not to. I was content with my life after retiring from MasterCard. And then this call comes, and I said no. And then the call came again, and I said, which part of no did you get the first time? That changed to this, because eventually when you get a call that says the president would really like to speak to you, that is when you no longer have the chance to say, which part of no did you get? It doesn't take you very far. So that ended that discussion, and I'm ended up there. And now that I'm here, aside from the fact that I've always wanted to be a part of an institution like this. If this had come to me near 5 years ago, I would not even have hesitated at the first call. Just stage of life things, right? That I had gone through a change, and now I had to accept another change. That's all it was. It was resistance to change that made me say no. But the reason I've always wanted to do something like this is because I believe the world's problems require long-term money with long-term patience. If you put short-term band-aid on the real challenges in the world of inequality, of climate change, which I consider these two to be the biggest sins in our world right now, if you put short-term money and short-term thinking to these two, you just end up with band-aid on an open wound. And the wound keeps getting bigger, and the band-aid keeps getting smaller. And so I have belief that the one institution in the world that has the ability to think long-term with long-term money is an institution like the World Bank. And there are other such institutions, but that was the one that I knew of, and that's the reason.
That's incredible. And I'm proud of you. I mean, I'm proud of what you're doing, and I'm grateful for it. Do a little bit of bridging to people of, okay, how does that, the goals of the World Bank, how does that connect to Bridgewater? And we'll go through that a little bit. And also, how does that? How do we connect as friends? What was the arc? So you've heard me say this. At Bridgewater, when we do things because either one, they are matter for somebody trying to understand how the world works. It's what we do. And or two, they're important to our clients. And you think about what Ajay just said, okay, the big regions in the world, the developing world, places like China was, like India, South Korea, Turkey, massively matter in the long term to anybody trying to understand where the world is headed in any serious way. And also specifically when you think about our clients, many of our clients care about specific regions like that. Either they care about them because of their investment goals or they care about them because those are neighboring sovereigns. They have impact on our clients. So you have those areas where clearly the economic questions, the development questions that Ajay and the World Bank is dealing with are on our radar and they matter to us. And that means that both they matter to our clients and also our ability to contribute to those questions. But then beyond that, Mick is here, one of the founders of Global Citizens. We're all global citizens. I don't mean literally global citizens, but we are citizens of the world. And we all have things that we deeply care about and we are carrying around a responsibility. And in my own journey of that, I am a part of Global Citizens. I sit on their board. And over the last couple of years with Mick and Hugh and others, I've had a lot of opportunities to get my head around some of the world's largest problems, basically. And within that, I chose specifically to kind of dip into the continent of Africa. And over the last couple of years, I've had the opportunity on the continent and off the continent to meet some of the heads of state. So we spend time with Porter in Ghana and Mick, sitting with the president, hearing what's on his mind, Prime Minister of Ivory Coast, Kenya, President of Malawi. And that meeting with the President of Malawi was super meaningful to me. I spent time when I was younger in Malawi. I traveled, I backpacked, I biked. Malawi, for those of you who haven't been, it's a very small, flat country with a huge lake and the nicest possible people. And I have such fond memories from Malawi. And I'm sitting across the President of Malawi, and he's shaken. And he knows of Bridgewater very well, and he's saying to me, Nir, you have no idea what I've been going through. He's like, I've been in the office for 3 years, and in every one of those years, I've had a national emergency. We were hit by COVID, and we had no vaccines and no treatments. And then the next year, we had mudslides that dislocated tens of thousands of people and killed many. And this year, we have the worst cyclone in the history of Malawi, again, dislocating people and killing a huge amount of people. And he's saying to me, and I don't know how to get out of it. I don't know how to get out of this cycle. I'm in a downward spiral because instead of putting money to rebuild Malawi, I can't service my debt, basically. And I have macroeconomic problems, hyperinflation, that I don't know how to get myself out of. And you could think it's a problem of one country, but it's a problem of a continent. It's a problem of a large part of the world. And I was thinking, as the president was speaking, I was thinking in my head, two things. One, shame on me for not knowing any of this. And I was thinking, this is a tractable problem. With the right understanding and the right action, we could be dealing with these things a lot better than we are. I come back from Ghana from this trip. I'm in Paris. There's a Power of the Planet event, and it's a beautiful spring day. Eiffel Tower, Ajay takes the stage. Ajay is less than a month in the job, Ajay. I'm sure you remember that. I think it was your first public appearance.
Less than a month, and I remember being there.
And he takes that. He takes the stage with Mia Motley, who is an incredible leader, the Prime Minister of Barbados. And Ajay takes the stage, and I think in one of his first public appearances, basically communicates that he is going to give a possibility for debt pause for countries that are dealing with natural disasters. Now, this blew my mind for the following reason. We know, Mick and I and others, that this was on the table for a long time. And no one had the guts to do it. It got stocky bureaucracy, and Ajay now getting on stage, and in his first month, that guy that blew my mind in the DSS year when I just started my job was doing another one of those. And I knew I liked the guy, but I liked you even more seeing that. And it was very, very inspiring, and then kind of corresponded with everything I've seen in Africa. And I'll just close this story and kind of, I want to get your reflection on some of this. But then 6 months later, we're in Davos. And in Davos, you're in Davos, and I'm in Davos, and Mick and Porter, and I asked to meet with you. And it's the last day of Davos. Trevor's there, Mick is there, Porter's there, you're there. I enter the room, I look at you, you're smiling, and I tell you, Ajay, I'm inspired. I think the understanding of Bridgewater can help. What can I do? And Ajay, in the same sharpness, looks at me and says, here's what matters. I'm going to let you speak to these things. Here are the things that matter that we got to move. And we're right now in the middle of the replenishment of IDA. This IDA gets replenished every 3 years, and I need your help. And that's basically, for those of you who are kind of trying to put the pieces together, this is how we got here. And since then, we'll talk, we'll pull, and Devin and others, since then, we've been on this partnership of trying to help with the replenishment. So one, that any reflections kind of on your part on that, and then specifically if you can speak to what are the things that matter, kind of the four things that we're trying to move, and where are we in the process of replenishment of IDA, and then we'll go into Africa a little bit.
You go back to that point about long-term attacking inequality and climate change. So I've said that, if you Google, you'll find I've said this a long time ago, that the world's problems are on three sides of a triangle. So I broke it into these three for my people at MasterCard at that time to identify with why MasterCard was getting involved with this topic. Why was it privately owned, as in publicly owned, but private from the viewpoint of a government? Why was a privately owned entity bothering about financial inclusion? Why was a privately owned entity incentivizing its customers to plant trees? And I was trying to explain to people, it's because the biggest challenges are one versus many, because society had become a point where I grow at your expense. That one versus many is a problem. That's an inequality. And then the other one was humanity versus nature, which was the climate change topic. And the reason the triangle didn't fall down was because the bottom is the difficult one. It's the incentivization of short-term over long-term. So whether a CEO or a teacher or a mayor of a town, short-termism is what you get pushed into by the system. And when you put that together, you get this band-aid problem. What I think needs to change, if we can fix this correctly in Africa, and why Africa? Africa is 1 billion people. China and India put together about 3. If you add China, India, and Africa together, that's 4 out of 8. If you can't get those, and those 4, China's done pretty well. India hopes to do even better. But Africa doesn't know what it wants to be. It hasn't had a chance to do that yet. As 600 million people out of the 1 billion plus in Africa do not have access to electricity. And I don't mean 2 hours a day. I mean none. So when you fly over the continent at night and you're not in Malawi on a bike, but you're flying over it, look down, it's dark. It's not dark because there aren't people. It's dark because they're living the way their forefathers and their forefathers' forefathers lived. They have no electricity. And if you don't have electricity, around the world, everybody's talking about AI and data and the power of digital. How do you plan to charge your phone like that? It doesn't work. You have to have basic power, basic electricity, basic connectivity, basic capability to get a fiber optic cable with a cell phone tower, things that matter, which we take for granted in every other place. So you need some basics, whether those basics are infrastructure of this type, or drinking water that's available, or healthcare that's delivered in a way. You need basic infrastructure. But those are what we began to talk about. But then what you need beyond that, and I think this is really, it's even after Davos, this has become more of a challenge for me. I started talking about it in Davos and panels. Currently, it consumes me. 1.2 billion young people in the global south. I don't like the term because it's like weird. It's a weird way of discussing countries, but the emerging markets, 1.2 billion people, will become eligible for a job in the coming 10 to 12 years in those countries. Currently, those countries are on a forecasted likely generation of jobs of between 400 and 450 million. It's a good number, but it's 800 million short of 1.2 billion. So effectively, two out of three kids have no hope for a job in the coming 12 years in those countries. So now, when you're a young person growing up, and you talk about a demographic dividend, which is how in the West we talk about this for others. It's not a demographic dividend if you don't get clean air and clean water when you're growing up and a job when you're ready. So how do you get jobs in Africa? I would say there are five verticals that matter, all of which connect to the kind of work you guys do. The first one is basically providing electricity. If you provide electricity, the generation, transmission, and distribution, of course, creates jobs. But the biggest job you create is what electricity enables at the end, which is, you know, factories to be opened, digital content to be created, the things that we take for granted while creating jobs. The second is other infrastructure. Physical infrastructure, bridges, roads, airports. But what really is interesting is railroad. There are very few railroad connectivities in Africa. So when you want to move, you know, let's say you want to mine rare earths in Zambia and you want to bring them, not just mined as in raw material, but after some value-added manufacturing. So you do it the right way. You now want to bring it out to Durban in South Africa to put it on a ship to bring it to Europe or the US or China or India or wherever it's going. That's a 42-day transit by road, 42 days. If you had a railroad, it would be 40 hours. 42 days versus 40 hours is one thing for rare earths. Now let's convert that to food. And it's not going to work. So the continent of Africa, and this is the third part, is agriculture as a business. The continent of Africa has plenty of arable land and plenty of drinking water, but no irrigation. Only 6% of Africa is irrigated, and their output per hectare is one-third that of the rest of the world, because they don't use fertilizers. And when they do, they use the wrong ones because they don't have soil testing stations. To be completely clear, a soil testing station can be put up on these two chairs put together. That's what it takes. They don't have that. So you've got a place that is food stressed that could become food surplus and could provide food to other countries in Africa if they had railroads and, you know, warehouses with cold chains and so on, none of which they have. So that's the second and third opportunity. The fourth is healthcare, not just because I want you to be healthier, but because if you do it through primary health centers, you will create jobs for nurses, medical technicians, doctors, PPE manufacturing, vaccine manufacturing, and most importantly, you'll create a diagnostic network so you can catch the next pandemic before it erupts in your face, which today we don't have. So that's the fourth one. And the fifth one is tourism. The real tourism possibilities in Africa are boundless. They have every possible attraction for people like us who like traveling, not just for a backpacker serving time between his duty in the Israeli army, which I suspect is what he was doing, because they go to two or three countries. One of those is India. Some are in Africa. And I kind of have friends from that time whom I got to know who are now 65 years old like me, which is interesting. And but also because you have water, beaches, sports, mountains, culture, food, and wildlife. You could make Africa an incredibly powerful, ecologically sensitive tourism place and create multiples of jobs. Every dollar invested in tourism creates 10 jobs for every dollar invested in manufacturing. Now, they're not the same quality of job, but you know, if you're in Africa, it's very easy for a Western person to pontificate about good jobs versus bad jobs. Kind of a job is kind of important. And so just think this through, these five verticals, and think of the power of these. The public sector, governments, multilateral banks, with our leverage, we can only do some part of this. The only way you'll get trillions to work is by getting the private sector to see a rational return on their money invested in these five verticals. That's our task. Find a way to make people understand the criticality of this problem through data that is irrefutable. Find a way to raise that to the right level of social consciousness through partners who know how to do it. and then find a way to get the private sector to bring its money to play, people like you, people like BlackRock, people like Scottish Widows and Ontario Teachers Pension Plan and solar farm operators and the Tatas in India and all these guys, and make them think about the opportunities in the emerging markets to change the course of history.
So this picture, there's a demographic picture, which is going to matter. We have population collapse in most of the rest of the world. We have rapidly growing population on the continent and in the conditions that Ajay was describing. And he basically gave the same kind of framework that he just shared with you guys, to Porter and Mick and I back in Davos. We were like, compelling. And then we basically split that into two parts. One is the what is. Like, let's actually get our head around what's going on. And then based on that, we can reflect that to others, private and public sector, and then we can decide what to do about it based on true information. And I want to pull Devin in. So we come back from Davos, and we say, who wants to take part in this? Devin Long, many of you know, but for those of you who don't know, has been in Bridgewater for 12 years, came in out of Harvard, computer science major, went and led our trading analytics team, and then did a little bit of client service, I think, and portfolio construction. But over the last several months has led a team that is partnering with the World Bank and others in going through this research. So, Devin, I'd love to hear from you a little bit about the team, a little bit of the research, and any reflections that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to share sort of two things. One is just sort of, my reflections on how I got involved in this and what I got personally out of it and what role I think Bridgewater can play in this stuff. And then second, I'll give some of the highlights from the research we've been doing. I think for me, as long as I've been here, I've sort of had this notion in the back of my head that the unbelievable research capability we have here could be pointed at questions like policy and questions like development. I think that comes from this idea that, look, we're trying to understand the economic machine, break it down into cause-effect linkages, use logic and analytics to understand those linkages, and then put everything together into a framework, and then use that framework to answer questions like how actions by certain players or actions by policymakers can lead to different economic outcomes. So in many ways, this stuff really rhymes with what our bread and butter is and what our DNA is. When Porter and Nir came to me 6 months ago and talked about what they were doing and the partnership they had with Global Citizen, the World Bank, it was like, wow, that sounds exactly like what I want to do. And, I raised my hand to get involved in it. And, one thing that was really inspirational for me was seeing how many other people around Bridgewater felt the same way. And like dozens of people reached out to me and said, hey, how can I be involved in this? And all contributed. And, it's more than I can name, but I wanted to especially thank Ika, Porter, Will, Danny, Tyler, and Jeremy, who I think contributed uniquely to the work we did. And, beyond just the folks at Bridgewater, one thing that was really special about this was it gave us so much surface area to go talk to people in the outside world and build partnerships with new organizations we otherwise wouldn't have worked with. We built some partnerships with think tanks like the Center for Global Development, who specialize in policy in the region and development. We talked to some real thought leaders on development economics like Larry Summers. We spend a lot of time with literal on-the-ground practitioners, private investors, VC, PE, infrastructure, who are on the continent actually building projects, building power plants, building bridges, several of whom are actually Bridgewater alum, which was pretty cool to just sort of see what people leave here and go on and do. And then, of course, amazing we get to host the World Bank today. To me, that sort of collection of things really feels like Bridgewater at its best, and it's been one of the highlights for me over my past decade here, like taking our incredible research capability, pointing it at a problem that really matters, working with like the smartest, best people in the world to understand it, and then using our brand, our platform, our network to sort of shine light on a problem that I think really matters for us, matters for investors, and matters for the world. So it's really been wonderful, and I'm super excited by what we've done here. And then what I wanted to do was sort of just share some of the highlights of the research. Nir said I only have 5 minutes. There's so much to say. What we're going to do is, we put together a long form report. We're going to release that internally and externally in the next couple of weeks. So think of this as like the appetizer for that and hopefully a useful setup for Ajay. But 5 minutes, 5 points. Some of these are things that, Ajay kind of highlighted, but I'll, use some of the charts to bring them to life. So one is the unbelievably big demographic shifts that are happening in the world. And these things play out slowly, so it's hard to, sometimes you can miss them, but over the periods of decades, they totally reshape the world. So You know, in most of the world, the developed world, US, Europe, Japan, and China, populations are either growing slowly, flatlining, or even outright shrinking. And the opposite is playing out in sub-Saharan Africa. So you can see this is basically world X sub-Saharan Africa. Populations are projected to flatline and even shrink in the coming decades. In sub-Saharan Africa, they're projected to keep growing extremely quickly. And what that means is that in the course of the coming decades, the composition of the world's labor force will radically change. So today, something like 10% of the world's working age population lives in sub-Saharan Africa. In the next few decades, that number is going to rise to something like 25%. So fully a quarter of all the working age people in the world will live in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's more than United States, Europe, Japan, developed world, China combined. So truly a massive shift in where the productive capability in the world is going to be. And then, you know, I think one of the big things in our mind is, well, what happens alongside that demographic explosion? And to sort of cartoon it a bit, there's sort of two trajectories you've sketched out. One trajectory looks like what happens if that's paired with steep productivity growth, something like what's played out in China or India in recent decades. And, you know, just to sort of pencil it out, sub-Saharan Africa, we think, could go from something like 5% of global growth to 10, 15, 20% of global growth in the coming decades. And in many ways can be the next great engine of global growth. And as folks come online here and populations decrease elsewhere, it can be the next major source. On the other hand, I think there's obviously a real tragedy if that doesn't play out and the region's productivity flatlines. And I think there's a lot of lenses to look at this. One that I find very stark is just looking at the number of people in the world who live in extreme poverty and where they live. And if you roll back the clock 30 years to the early 90s, there were something like 2 billion people living in extreme poverty in the world. This means people who live on less than the equivalent of $2 a day. And that's come down significantly. That's this red line here. This is ex sub-Saharan Africa. And a lot of that is the story of China and the story of India developing and lifting hundreds of millions, 1.5 billion people out of poverty. And at the same time, sub-Saharan Africa, that hasn't played out yet. And you've seen poverty rates flatline, and in some cases even pick up. And you can even see on the chart, this is COVID hitting right here. This is the number of people in extreme poverty rising as a result of that. And so, you know, you could imagine playing this forward for a few decades. If the region's able to get on an India-like growth trajectory, this line comes down, and the last major population center in the world emerges out of poverty. On the other hand, if you don't, it means that the fastest growing region in the world is the one where there's the most poor people. So I think there's a real sense of urgency and importance, and I think we're at a real inflection point. So in terms of, you know, given that backdrop, you know, what do you do about it? I think there's a lot of dimensions to that. The one I want to highlight for this group that really stuck out to us as we started this is just the criticality and the need for more investment. And by investment, we mean things like core infrastructure, you know, roads, ports, railroads, energy. We mean investment in human capital, education, sanitation, healthcare. And we mean productive capabilities, factories, call centers, shopping centers, real estate. And, you know, I think one thing that's kind of stark is if you look at sort of the past 40 years, what is the investment levels? So investment as a share of GDP in sub-Saharan Africa look like? It's been about 15% of GDP. And as a point of reference, if you look at the places where there's been these incredible productivity booms, your China's, your Korea's, your Vietnam's, it's been about double that. And I think this is very intuitive. Like, the things I'm describing are the ingredients to an economy working. You need more of those ingredients to get more output. And then sort of the last two things I want to talk about is sort of what we see as the role of the private sector and then what we see as the role of MDBs. So on the private sector side, you know, the pool of capital is absolutely massive. So I think even if you look at just Bridgewater clients and our institutional investors, you're talking about tens of trillions of dollars of potential money. And even a small allocation to the region would be massive in the context of the needs, more than plug the gap we're talking about. But the reality is those private flows will only happen at scale if the ingredients and if the conditions are right on the ground. And the reality is there's big barriers today to that happening. There's immature infrastructure. So kind of some of the stories Ajay was describing of imagining you have a factory, but there's not reliable electricity or there's no way to get your goods to port. There's relatively weaker institutions. So property right enforcement, contract enforcement, rule of law, corruption, bureaucracy. And, you know, I think there's sort of pockets of exceptions. There are countries where this is not true and private sector can and is flowing. And there's sectors and players who are active in the region doing investment. We had the incredible opportunity to talk to a lot of them. But the reality is we believe if this is going to happen at scale, you really have to bring these barriers down. So last on the role of, you know, multilateral development banks, such as the World Bank, you know, I think that backdrop of this enormous demographic shift that's going on, the need for more investment, private sector can't yet play a big role, I think gives a huge opportunity and a big role for organizations like the World Bank to play. And I sort of think of it as them being sort of first movers in development stories or foundation builders. And I think it looks like a few things. One is, you know, directly financing poverty reduction projects, food security, healthcare, education, et cetera. And then the other looks like building the foundation that sets the right conditions for the private sector to then step in at scale. So things like building the railroads, the ports, the energy grids, things like helping create regulatory certainty and regulatory clarity. And then lastly, things like helping to mitigate the big risks that investors worry about in the region, things like political risk and things like currency risk. So hopefully I stuck to my 5 minutes. I mean, amazing to hear from you, Ajay. So I'll hand it back to you, Nir.
Great job. So I want to leave a couple of minutes for questions, but I have one question for Ajay and then one for Mick from Global Citizen. So Ajay, my last question to you is, I hope it's clear to people why the IDA, the mission, and then IDA within the mission, is so critical and why it matters. But my question to you is, why does that work matter? What Devin just said, why does it matter what Bridgewater does here to help? And then I'm going to want Mick, you to speak a little bit about the economic summit that we're all doing together to support IDA in October. So let's go to you first.
So I think the only thing I would add, and you came up with it later in terms of corruption, the like, I would put good governance and the spreading of good governance into these countries as a very important part of what needs to happen. And the bank should help through the knowledge bank and the academies we are creating to do that, plus incentivize countries to do the right regulatory policy changes through budgetary operations we can help them with to make them do this. But it's not necessary for the research. It's just for you that's a key thing that we should be doing. Why does all this matter? Because I think first, data matters, because data, the more of data like this there is out there, and the more it receives the light that it deserves to get, the more you get people paying attention to the topic. That's just very important. Your voice matters because you have a voice. And your voice matters with very serious private sector investors. But it also matters with governments who care about the flows of money that they could attract from these investors. And therefore, your voice matters. So both the data and your voice matter. Last point on connecting this to IDA for a minute. You remember I told you about those five verticals: electricity, infrastructure, agriculture, healthcare, and tourism. In electricity, we made an announcement that we will get to 300 million people by 2030 in Africa. 250 we'll do, 50 we'll do in partnership with a really good institution called the African Development Bank. They're smaller, but they're very powerful locally and regionally important. And so we're working with them. That's going to cost us $30 billion of IDA money. So what I'm trying to do is, instead of spreading the peanut butter thin and try and do everything that everybody wants, is to pick things that could make a quantum difference in a finite time to change the trajectory of what's going on in Africa for that research that you're demonstrating with. That's the links between what you're doing, what we're doing, how it connects to IDA, how I care about it, and why I admire the fact that you're willing to step up and help. We need a few more like you. And if you had time, I would tell you, if you get a question on this, I'll talk to you about what I'm trying to do with the private sector and a group of private sector people to convert these things into tangible actions that we can take.
So what are we doing to get more attention on the topic? Let's talk about the climate.
Yeah, thanks, Nir. My name is Mick Sheldrick. I'm co-founder at Global Citizen and Chief Policy Impact Government Affairs Officer. Delighted to be with you all today, and we've got members of a Global Citizen team around the back. I think the reason why this Economic Development Assembly, which Nir referenced, is important is to take a step back. When Ajay assumed the presidency, and in your opening address as part of your candidacy, he really spoke about this idea of the World Bank both being a better bank, but also a bigger bank. And I think, and much to the chagrin of Trevor and others, those of us in the advocacy space are very good at making asks for you to be a better bank. And Ajay, to his credit, and Nir referenced this on his 19th day in the job, has done a huge number of reforms. And in fact, those pause clauses that Nir referenced, I was with Prime Minister Motley of Barbados back in late May, and she was talking about the fact that she had signed almost a year later these pause clause agreements so that if there was a major hurricane, she would have this immediate relief. And lo and behold, the day I think you were meant to be flying out to see her, Hurricane Beryl, the longest living, fastest growing hurricane in the history of the Caribbean, was barreling down on Barbados. And fortunately, the damage wasn't to the degree of what was needed, but it meant so much that they had these clauses in case they needed to be activated. And so this is affecting real lives. But we also need a better bank. And when Nir referenced, we had that discussion in January, I think those of us in the advocacy sector who are calling for all these reforms, at the same time, there's only so much you can do without an upsurge, as Devin said, in public investment. And that's why we've really been calling with many of our partners, including Prime Minister Motley and others, for IDA to be increased. We want to see at least $120 billion from the world's wealthiest economies, principally the G7 and others, contributing. And so the Economic Development Assembly will be our contribution. It's taken place October 9 and 10 in Abidjan. I think it will be your last major stop before the World Bank annual meetings in DC, where all the finance ministers will come together. And the Economic Development Assembly, which will be presented with Bridgewater, Global Citizen, supported by the likes of the government of Cote d'Ivoire and Harif General Partners, which is an African-owned private equity fund based in South Africa, will really have three core objectives. The first is we will have the private sector and investors, not just from the continent, from Europe, from America, there participating. And we're calling it right now, and some of our team was in Abidjan last week with the Prime Minister. We're calling this the Abidjan Accord. And it will be an accord signed by the world's biggest brands and investors. And it will be them saying, you know, we see this potential, responding to the research that Devin so well articulated. We see the potential. We're interested in this in the long term, but we need public investment. And IDA is part of the solution to that. And back in that goal of 250 million people through IDA, supported with energy access. So that will be one, this huge call to action so that RJ can go to the annual meeting, speak to finance ministers, speak to treasuries, and say, look, investors and private sectors around the world, not just in Africa, but globally, want this to happen. And I can tell you, as we've been meeting with governments and finance ministers and others, parliamentarians in Canada, in the UK, they see Bridgewater's involvement and they say, wow, we haven't seen this before. Why are they involved? And they're seeing the research potential. The second and third goal is based on the research and the insights, and Devin, you know, Porter, Will, you guys have done an amazing job. We'll be looking at five leaders from across the continent to showcase, well, what are they doing to remove barriers? But also, what is the potential of what they can achieve if we're successful in getting this upsurge of funding in IDA? And I just want to say, like, a big thank you, because this is extraordinary, this research collaboration. I mean, RJ's doing this, but we need these governments to step up. And I can tell you, like, last week, you know, just to finish, we found ourselves on this toll bridge in Abidjan, and it was like the key landmark in the country, and we said, okay, we better go and visit this bridge. And as we were there, they were telling us that because this was supported with investment, private sector investment, IFC investment that RJ referenced, you know, this has reduced the time from one end of the city to the other by 2 hours, which has basically led to an upsurge of growth. I think they tracked it like 1 to 2% in economic growth annually. So this is, as well as obviously making ease in many citizens' lives. So this is the power of investment. And so thank you very much. Thank you, Nir, for your leadership. Thank you.
With that, let me say two things to close us off. One, I hope for all of us that we're going to crush it with the replenishment of IDA, deliver more than ever, and then thereafter with these super, super important goals for the world, not just for these regions. And we're your partners. We're here to help, AJ, hopefully for the long run. And then, more importantly, help me to thank AJ for coming here for the second time and spending time with us. I really appreciate you.